the Maine State Legislature, and education funding. Will anything change this year? Among the biggest issues before the state legislature right now is the matter of funding for public schools. In November, voters approved a measure to boost funding for schools by levying a 3% tax on income over $200,000. Legislative leaders believe the vote was a clear signal that the people of Maine want better funding for their schools. But many, especially Republicans, don't believe the income tax is the best way to get there. Meantime, the governor has proposed cutting education funding and creating a statewide teachers' contract. And local school boards are scrambling to pin down next year's budget. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with two state legislators who serve on the Education Committee about how the school funding formula works and what might happen next. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. School's almost out for students across the state, but it is not time to relax yet for our state legislators. They are still debating the ins and outs of how much funding will go to Maine's K through 12 public schools. Governor LePage's proposed budget includes cuts to education, raising issues about when and how the state will meet the mandated funding levels for all schools. We're going to talk about how the discussions in Augusta are going, and we'll try to make some sense of Maine's school funding formula. Joining me today, Representative Phyllis Ginsler. She's a Did I pronounce that right, Phyllis?
Ginsler.
Ginsler, thank you. Republican state representative from Bridgeton, who is the ranking minority member of the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. And Senator Rebecca Millett. Is it Millett or Millett?
Millett.
I should have asked you guys both this before we went on the air. We were just chatting away. Millett is a Democrat from Cumberland representing Senate District 2. She is also on the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions or concerns about how the state is allocating funds to Maine's public schools? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before we talk about the referendum question, before we talk about 55% EPS and all that, I want to talk about how the school funding formula works. Rebecca, it's property values of a town are part of the formula, but they're not the only thing in a formula, correct?
Yeah, I like to think of it in two parts. The first part is called the essential programs and services, which actually develops what the state believes is the minimum required to support an appropriate public education. So that takes into consideration teacher-to-pupil ratios, extracurricular activities, early childhood programs, et cetera, and it develops a per-pupil cost. Then that is multiplied by the number of students that are in the districts. And then there's the allocation methodology, which takes into consideration each community's ability to make contributions towards the cost of their public education system.
And it wildly varies between communities, right? Some
That's
get...
Right.
I read this morning Scarborough, only 6% of its school funding comes from the state under this formula, and yet Lewiston is in the 70 to 80%.
That's right.
Range.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, when I actually first began my service here in the state Senate, we embarked upon a review of the essential program services model and allocation methodology. The 125th legislature the year before had authorized this analysis and took a look at how is it working, is it fair, and interestingly, it came back saying, yes, actually, this is a national model. And, you know, I sometimes, when I was on the school board, would say, you know, if everyone's a little bit grumpy, it's probably working. And I think that's the case with the essential program services model and allocation methodology. Everyone feels as if they're not quite getting enough. But in the end, those communities that have really large property valuation are able to generate tax revenue to help support their schools, where there are other communities that are really struggling, some of our more rural northern schools, and they or schools that have very high economically disadvantaged students, then they need additional help from the state.
All right, you wanted to jump in, Phyllis. Go ahead.
Well, I think Senator Millett has given you a very good overview of essential programs and services. But I would probably agree with you about the disparate results when you use this formula. It is a very complex formula, as I have come to know. This is my first term on education committee. So one of the first things I did was delve into EPS, since it's pretty much the heart of how the state funds contributes funding to education. And my view of it was this very complex formula into which you put money, and then it sort of is distributed to various pipelines of various lengths and widths, and out comes a very fragmented funding. And I would call them winners and losers, is what emerges. The school district that educates the children in my town is what you call a minimum receiver district, which means it gets, like Scarborough that you mentioned, receives only about 6 to 8%, I can't remember the exact amount, of state funding toward education. And yet, our population has a, or our community has a free and reduced lunch population over 60%.
So, do you think the reason is because you represent the Bridgeton area,
yes,
where there are
mm-hmm.
summer homes and things
That's
like that,
correct.
So some property values that are high.
That exactly. We are in the Lakes region. That's right.
And doesn't this, and correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't it serve a bit of a disadvantage to places that maybe service communities where there's a high property value, but there's also a lot of property that's not even on the tax rolls?
So there are a lot, like I said earlier, there are a lot of people who are very dissatisfied with the amounts that they're getting. And that came up during our discussion over the past 4 years. We on the Education Committee felt like there are probably things that we could do on our end to make it more fair, like include income, the average income of the community in part of the calculation and ability of a community to pay. And that actually, according to the consultants that were chosen by the governor's administration, determined actually made things worse, and it surprised all of us. But what I think is an important aspect of all of this is that those consultants also made a point that for those communities that do have property-rich houses or families who live on a property that maybe is more than what they can afford in terms of their property taxes, things like the homestead exemption program, the property tax fairness program, are essential partners to the education funding formula, because no community is homogenous. Every community will have its middle and lower income families, and they need to be given help when overall the community is determined to be property wealthy. But there are those that are actually struggling economically.
Phyllis, is the issue here, and I'm going to back up a little bit. I've been a reporter in Maine long enough to remember the debate over whether or not the essential programs and, well, even creating the essential programs and services model, and then whether or not the state ought to fund that at 55%. It was decided, and it was a bipartisan vote more than a decade ago to fund education at the 55% level, but it's never been reached. Is that part of the issue here, not only that there are winners or losers, but that the 55% has never even happened?
It's been a struggle for everybody, a challenge for everybody. In the Baldacci administration, when the governor and the House of Representatives and the Senate were all of the same party, the challenge was still there, was not reached. So the question is, are we chasing something? Are we chasing this 55% model appropriately? The way I look at it is that rather than look at a dollar amount placed into a system which may or may not be producing the results that we want, let's take a very hard look at the policies that we want to implement to change the way we are educating our children, and particularly changing and improving the outcomes that we fully expect.
What do you mean by looking at policies?
Well, right now, there's a couple of results that come out of the way we fund education. we have a system, a public school system, that is built to accommodate and educate somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 students. We no longer have 250,000 students. We have fewer than 180,000 students. And the projections look like we're in a few years, we're probably going to level off to 155,000 students. So if you think about it, if you're trying to sustain an infrastructure and overhead that is wrongly sized, you're probably using money that could better be used in the classroom.
Isn't the problem, though, where we're losing students? There's only so far you can bus a student every day. You know, it may be that in Aroostook County, Piscataquis County, there are fewer and fewer students. But to close schools to save infrastructure costs or superintendent costs might mean busing some children 2 hours each way.
Yeah, well, I'm not suggesting that we go back to the Baldacci plan, which was not, I don't think it was successful in regionalizing the actual schools. But what about taking a look, again, at overhead and doing a much better job in regionalizing administrative services and regionalizing those types of programs that lend themselves very, very well to regionalization, one of them being special education. So I think that we can take a look very hard at the way we are funding the various pieces and parts of what constitute education. I'd like to see, from a policy point of view, that we put much more emphasis and therefore dollars directly into the classroom. Right now, the calculation is about, for every dollar that we spend, only 59 cents actually gets spent in the classroom for instruction. So I would like to see that, and I believe in the this administration has targeted moving that to 70 cents for every dollar directly related to classroom instruction. So something, a policy that supports students and teachers.
Rebecca, I know that the governor believes that we have too many administrators in Maine. We have too many superintendents. Is that part of the cost problem?
The cost of system administration is roughly $96 million out of a multi-billion dollar budget. So I really think that that's focusing in the wrong direction. And in fact, over the past 8 to 10 years, the cost of system administration has gone down in Maine. There's current statute in place that allows for communities to come together and share their administrative expenses. I certainly think the past experience with the consolidation under the Baldacci administration is a perfect example of forcing districts or communities to do things they don't really want to do. Doesn't end well. In fact, over the past several months in the Education Committee, we've been dealing with the breakup of communities that were put together that never really probably wanted to be put together. I also would like to just briefly address the declining student argument. The Central Program Services model is designed to recognize the number of students. It was purposely created that way. So what the Department of Education is putting out as the cost of education reflects those declining student enrollments. And finally, I have a lot of concern around talk around regionalizing special education and other types of educational programs. We have been working very hard in Maine and across the nation to mainstream all of our students and to allow everyone the opportunity to be in school together. And I know that from my own children, they benefit very greatly of having every student in the classroom with them so that they're aware that their experience is not everyone else's experience. So I will look very cautiously upon any recommendations to do that.
We're having this conversation in large part today because the voters passed a referendum in November, a controversial referendum, legislative leaders who have been on Maine Calling say, yes, we recognize, whether or not we liked the referendum, we recognize that, this is the voters' way of saying we want more funding for education. Phyllis, my question for you, I'm guessing because you're a Republican, you did not like the referendum. You do not like this 3% tax on income over $200,000. Am I right in that assumption? And if so, where do you see the money coming from, if not from there?
You are right, Jennifer. I was vocal in the last election cycle last year in my opposition to question two. And each town in my district rejected question two. So clearly I do not feel any allegiance to question two. I think that the 3% surcharge is probably one of the worst measures that has been enacted in law in Maine. It is very harmful to our state, to its economic prospects, and frankly, it hits very, very hard on small business families and professional people, both of which are vital to our economic success here in Maine. So I do not think that we should certainly do that. I think the measure was very harmful, and I believe we should get rid of it. The funding, again, I would say that the funding really should follow the policy. And if you can demonstrate a really good policy, then I think the funding will follow that.
Senator Millett, do you believe that at the end of the day, at the end of this legislative session, this 3% surtax will stand? And if not, where do you believe? Do you believe that the legislature will be trying to find money for education from another source?
It's really hard for me to say at this point where we will end up. But I will say unequivocally, we recognize the will of the voters. This is the second time they've come forward and said, we want the state to fund 55% of the total cost of education. And, you know, I'm not on the taxation committee. I'm not a tax expert. But I do know that because of Maine voters, we're in a position today to fully fund education for the first time in a decade. And eliminating the surcharge would, at this point, ignore the will of the voters. That would be a path that we would need to be very careful about. Certainly, you know, I would be interested to hear what the alternatives are. If it's not the surcharge, what's the plan?
There are serious discussions, though, going on in Augusta about what do we do? If we are going to go against the will of the voters and take away this surcharge, are we going to do something in its place? Am I inaccurate in that? I mean, there are serious discussions about where do we find the money to hit 55%.
Well, I would say there's also serious discussions about how you calculate 55%. And this is a point of disagreement. I think it's important for your listeners, Jennifer, to know that before $1 is placed in that funnel called EPS, the state, and that means the taxpayers, have already committed nearly $200 million related to K through 12 education. But it doesn't count in the 55%. So I think that, and this is my position and perhaps position of some of my caucus, is that unless we're honest about how much money we're really spending on K through 12 education, I am not of the opinion that we should be chasing this 55 as it's defined right now.
What is that $200 million you're talking about?
So that $200 million includes teacher retirement. It includes health benefits. It includes for teachers. It includes the Department of Education, which exists for K through 12 education, and other initiatives. So I believe we should be counting that.
So if I can respond to that, you know, there's all this talk about trying to get more money into our classrooms, and this is a perfect example of finding a budget gimmick to avoid putting tax dollars into the classroom. The teacher retirement that was mentioned, that's unfunded actuarial liability. That is a result of the state decision in not funding the retirement amount. And to put that in as a as a cost of education in our classrooms, I will not support and have not supported. I'm kind of surprised that we're even here talking about this, because we took a vote in the Education Committee. It was unanimous towards the actual true definition of the essential programs and services as defined by statute. And it was only until a day later that that we saw sort of this backpedaling about what that 55% actually is. But if we're serious about getting our tax dollars into the classroom, this is the surest way to make sure it doesn't happen.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about education funding in Maine. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Coffee by Design, a locally owned business committed to quality. Roasted to order coffees available online at coffeebydesign.com. And Silly's Restaurant in Portland's East End. Open at 11 Wednesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends. With vegan and gluten-free options. Silly's.com.
Thomas Ricks covered the Pentagon for the Washington Post and wrote the bestseller Fiasco about the Iraq War. He says his new book, Churchill and Orwell, is about two men who didn't put politics ahead of the facts. On the next Fresh Air, Ricks also discusses three generals in the Trump administration, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly, whom he's covered. And I review the new Twin Peaks. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 right here on Maine Public Radio. The PBS NewsHour on Maine Public Television stands apart. It's news the way you want and expect your television news to be. Each evening at 7, a full hour of coverage. The top stories and issues of the day, objectively explored and discussed in depth with differing viewpoints. News you can trust, with prominent guests and intelligent voices. The most important issues of the day from around the globe, all helping to make sense of our complicated and ever-changing world. That's the PBS NewsHour at 7 weeknights on Maine Public Television and at 10 on the Maine Public Television World Channel.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, state education funding. What is the outlook for Maine school districts? Here with me in our Augusta studio, Senator Rebecca Millett, who is a Democrat from Cumberland County. She's on the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. And Representative Phyllis Gensler, who is a Republican from Bridgeton, also on the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Rhonda Sperry. She is superintendent of RSU 64, serving Bradford, Corinth, Hudson, Kanduskeg, and Stetson. Hi, Rhonda. Thanks for joining us, and tell us a little bit about your school district.
For having me. I serve in a district that actually supports around 1,052 children each day, inside and outside of classrooms. We're just outside the more metropolitan area of Bangor, and we enjoy a very rural setting for our students. We have very supportive families and certainly very supportive taxpayers, both on the state and local level. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to do the things we do for our students each and every day.
Rhonda, how difficult is it for you and your school board to come up with a budget when the debate is going on in Augusta over the funding for education?
Well, first, let me say I'm so appreciative of the fact that we have Senator Millett and Representative Gensler willing to have these kinds of conversations in such a public environment, because the last thing we want are these conversations to end. We'll be able to come to resolution that will meet the needs of the students in the state, I believe, but that will only come through these kinds of progressive dialogues. The school board in my district has been very challenged to present a budget over the last couple of years that will keep the district moving forward in the way that we want it to. This year, it's projected we will lose $204,000 in state subsidy. That's on top of last year's reduction in subsidy of $134,000. That's a total of $338,000 over 2 years, and that's a significant impact to our local budget, as you can imagine.
Let me ask you this. We haven't brought this up yet on the program, but I want to find out what you think about it. The governor has proposed a statewide teacher contract, noting the fact that many teachers will leave rural districts for higher paying districts and hoping to keep that from happening. Does that happen in RSU 64? And do you support the idea of a statewide teachers contract?
It does happen in RSU 64 and in other rural districts that I have been privileged to work in. What often happens is teachers may start in a rural district and gain very appropriate and extensive professional development and training in the classroom while they're applying everything they learned in the post-secondary environment. And then when they get a few years of experience, they're often snatched up by maybe a higher paying district. And so we do have that challenge here in RSU 64. I actually am a proponent of a statewide teachers contract. I think that it does some great things for students across a larger region, like a state, that will help to kind of level that playing field and give kids access to the best educators we can possibly hire. I'm not a proponent of this notion that only our best teachers get paid the best amount, and therefore it complicates what actually happens in the classroom. I think a statewide contract, although the work to get to that is significant, a statewide contract certainly would benefit our kids in the long run. You know, the demands of a teacher in Fort Kent and the demands of a teacher in Cape Elizabeth, they're the same, and we want the very best for all kids across the state of Maine.
All right. Well, Rhonda, thank you so much for your call. Rhonda Sperry, superintendent of RSU 64. Rebecca and Phyllis, do you all support the idea of a statewide teachers contract?
I do. This is Representative Gensler. Yes, I support it. I think it is another way also that we can increase the funding that goes directly into the classroom.
So we have several bills that are in front of the committee as we speak. I think we're going to be working them tomorrow. And it certainly is a very interesting topic that I think we need to take a close look at. After the two public hearings that we held, it's very clear there are a lot of questions that still need to be answered around this effort. In fact, the department reworked a bill substantially in between a public hearing and one of the first work sessions we have. For me, that's a sign that it's just not ready for prime time yet. I certainly would welcome working with the department and looking at this idea closer. But one important aspect of the proposals that are in front of us for both of these statewide teacher contract bills is that it does allow communities to pay a salary above and beyond what the negotiated state amount is. And that will allow what everyone is saying is the problem to be perpetuated further, even with a statewide contract.
So the cost of living is different in different parts of Maine, dramatically different in different parts of Maine.
That's correct. But I'm just saying that as these proposals are put in front of us currently, it does allow for communities to pay above whatever the state negotiates, which then would perpetuate this problem that was just discussed, that there may be communities that decide to pay more than the statewide contract amount and then will be able to continue to draw those experienced teachers to their schools.
All right. We're going to go to Sarah, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Oh, hi. I'm on the school board here in Brunswick, and I do want to say that as a school board member, I actually don't support a statewide teachers contract. I like the local control that we have. But my question is, we are currently facing a huge budget gap. We're being told by the governor's proposed budget and our ED-279 that we'll be losing $1 million. If question two was being implemented, we would be gaining $3.1 million. So we're looking at a $4.1 million gap between basically what the Republicans and the Democrats are saying. And we are now on Wednesday night going to vote to cut freshman sports. We're going to vote to cut multiple teaching positions. I just feel like, can the legislators comment on how this budget process puts every school board in this worst position that we're having to negotiate, some really difficult decisions because the governor has set these expectations so low. And we need the $3.1 million. We need to be adding to our programming right now, not cutting. And I don't know what the representative meant when she said that we could centralize or regionalized special ed. We do special ed in our schools. We are all required to do it by state and federal law. So I don't know. I know it's a complicated question, but we really need the extra money. We do not need to be losing money in our school district right now.
All right, Sarah, I definitely want to have both of our guests respond. Rebecca, go ahead.
A couple of things. First of all, we recognized in the Education Committee last session that there is a real problem way our process is working in contrast to where school boards need to be making their decisions ahead of when we ever, year after year, complete our business. So we unanimously passed out of committee, and it went into law last year, would allow districts to vote in language to give them the flexibility to expend additional funds received post-school budget vote, in recognition of the fact that oftentimes, or at least since I've been on board, we have always approved money above and beyond the governor's recommendation for education. So I have been trying to get that word out to through the Superintendents Association and to the School Boards Association. So this is just one more opportunity for me to make the plug that you have that flexibility.
But they're still making that budget without knowing what the final number is going to be.
Yes. And having served on the school board for 6 years myself, I really recognize that that's a challenge. And we're still struggling to find a way to alleviate that gap. But at least this provides them a little bit of flexibility going down the road. And I just would like to say that indeed, you know, with the state funding 55% of the total cost of education, no schools would face a decline in state funding. Every school would see an increase, and some are in the magnitude of 300%, 200%, like Hancock would see a 336% increase. Gilead would see a 211% increase. So that you know, I have been in this legislature for 5 years now, and every year I've been fighting for us to meet that obligation of 55%. And this year, I believe we will reach that.
Representative Gensler.
So I guess I will start by saying that this administration over the last two budget cycles has increased baseline funding for education, K-12 education in the EPS model by $100 million. And yet, we still have a disparate result coming when we go through this funding model. And clearly, there needs to be a much better way that we can address the specific classroom needs. That's really where the state can put its funds to the best use. And if we can do that, then I think that Brunswick and other districts will have much more flexibility in terms of programs than they do now if their classroom was more fully funded. And that I think is really where I'd like to see us go. The administration has put forward a blueprint right now in the terms of the proposal. And I think that blueprint starts to nudge us over to those goals. And so there are certain districts that, just as every biennium, every year, when we use the CPS formula, winners and losers, it's a very complex formula. But I believe that if the overarching goal is to, for example, place 70% or 70 cents on the dollar into the classroom, that will benefit everyone hugely.
If I may just respond to that. So the essential programs and services model is absolutely designed to recognize the resources required for our children in the classroom. That's the actual language in statute. That is what the model represents. And when we say, and when the voters have said twice now that we want the state to fund 55% of the essential programs and services model, it's very clear that that's where the monies go. And so there's no disagreement there. Where I think we break down is when the proposal that's coming out of the House Republicans includes things like teacher retirement and the Department of Education overhead, that money is not going into the classroom. That money is just an overhead expense. So, I think we were very clear in that vote that we took that we agreed to fund 55% of the essential programs and services as defined by law, and that's the target.
And Representative Ginsler, we have at least two Facebook posts here. John, why are we even talking about question two? The time to debate it was before the election in November. People voted for it, so the legislature should implement it, right? Deb on Facebook, as someone who had children in the public school systems and who would pay the 3% surcharge for education passed by Maine voters, and she has passed by Maine voters in all caps, I urge the legislature and the education committee to honor the will of their constituents. I understand your constituents in your regions did not vote for question two, but the state did. And is that just a starting point, or is that not law now?
It is law. It's a harmful law. It will have a serious negative impact on our economic prospects, and I believe we're already feeling it. And I think it's foolhardy, and it needs to be repealed.
I would just say that I respect the democratic process. There certainly have been referendum results that I personally have disagreed with, but I don't believe that we're in a position to dramatically misinterpret what the will of the voters was. You know, they told us very clearly states should fund 55% of the cost of education. They didn't ask us to come up with a bunch of budget tricks or gimmicks to make it look like we're meeting our obligations. They want us to actually do it. And, you know, this is really about property tax relief. This is about taking back that shift of costs that we have put onto our property taxes and putting it back towards the 55% that we have not met.
May I respond to
yes,
that?
Yes, go ahead, Phyllis.
I mentioned before that this administration in the last two budget cycles has added $100 million to the baseline of funding education. I'd like to know how many of your listeners felt any decrease in property taxes based on that $100 million increase. Frankly, I don't see the connection. I've never seen the connection. Mostly what happens when education funding is increased is that so is spending. So and it may be perfectly valid. But certainly reducing property taxes can be handled much better in other ways. So I don't see a connection between the two.
Well, okay, I need to address that. There has been a very, very small infinitesimal change in the overall mill rate that's expected from our communities to pay towards public education because, in fact, while the governor says that he's put $100 million in, it's actually been the result of the legislature that has negotiated additional funding above the governor's proposed amounts. And even with that, even with our putting in an extra money, we're still hovering around 47%.
Okay, we have to go to a break. We're late for that. But thank you, Sarah, for your call, and we will be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, committed to driving transformation for a healthier future for the people of Maine. Anthem.com. And Roosevelt Campobello International Park, a legacy of friendship between two great nations. Open May 27th. Details at fdr.net.
With the nation years into a recovery, food aid is dwindling for hungry people in places like southwestern Virginia.
Used to, my man would go over there, that guy with the hat on there, he might go over and get two pickup truckloads. Now, he went over there this morning, got three boxes.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Surplus food and empathy are scarce. Who is caring for America's poor? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening right here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock, we'll have Commonwealth Club of California. We'll take a look at the future of the clean energy movement in the current political climate. That's on the Commonwealth Club of California coming up at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, funding for Maine's K-12 public schools. With me in our Augusta studios, two state legislators on the Education and Cultural Affairs Committee, Representative Phyllis Ginsler and Senator Rebecca Millette. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I have a feeling this is going to be one of those calls, one of these programs where we don't get to everybody's call because so many people have something they'd like to say. say. But before we go back to the calls, I want to ask each of you, it sounds like there's still a great deal of difference between the two parties and the approach to education. I was under the understanding that there was a lot of discussions going on to try to come to a place of agreement. But listening to both of you today, it doesn't feel as though there's a place of agreement and that we're going to have a month from now some sort of cohesive, unanimous recommendation out of your committee.
Well, the recommendations have been issued from the Education Committee. The conversation really now is resting with the Appropriations and Financial Affairs Committee, and I do know that they are having conversations, and we're now kind of on the outside looking in. But I do think that our discussion today is a good representation probably of what some of the talking points are.
I think it is very difficult when you are making when you're proposing changes to the status quo. And I think that those, some of the issues, obviously, all of them, are complex issues. And I think the agreement here is that we need to work very hard to come up with solutions that really benefit our students and our teachers. So I think that's the point of agreement.
We'll go to Chris, who's calling from Somerville. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. It's been interesting listening. I actually come from a school system where we are regionalizing a lot of the services and working with other surrounding schools on sharing special education programs and things like that. And we actually have administrative costs that are much lower per pupil than the state average, but we've still been facing property tax increases year over year because while the education dollars from the state have increased somewhat, it's still a decreasing percentage of calculated PS supposed to be going to school. So we're sliding behind. Our costs are actually going up for what tuitions are charged in high schools we send our kids to, for our special ed costs, for salaries, for energy, all kinds of things. And those increases just don't match that. We're still left with a problem. I noted that there was a vote in the Education Committee earlier this year, unanimously in support of 55% of school funding and in defiance of governor's budget cuts. But then just a few days later, they reversed and voted for a proposal that just shifts costs. And it doesn't give one penny more to funding classrooms than the governor proposed. And that's part of the problem. No matter how you're going to calculate what you think should be part of the 55%, if you're really just shuffling the deck chairs, that doesn't solve the problem of where the cost of education is not something that's going to head down. Not many things today do go downwards. And it's increasingly falling on property taxes that people are having a hard time affording. I don't understand why. What was going on in people's minds when they changed course on the Education Committee on that, and why they don't understand how serious voters are about the property tax relief.
Okay, Representative Gensler.
Hello, Senator Johnson. How are you?
Good.
I think that's who's calling. Senator Johnson and I served together on the Judiciary Committee in my first term. So I would say that I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I apologize because now I wanted to say hello to Chris and then.
Well, I think his point was even with trying to regionalize, other costs are going up, mm-hmm. so we don't see the relief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's fair to say that there is full support for raising funding for classroom instruction. That is a given. Where there is not agreement, perhaps, is in the other parts, which represent somewhere around 35 to 40% of the rest of the funding. So if we're talking about increasing funding for inside the classroom for teachers and for students and helping to improve outcomes, we're all in.
when you say other costs, we've already talked about administration. Do you mean the increase in health insurance coverage for teachers? Do you mean the increase in heat costs? Or what are we talking about when you say other
costs?
Well,
I include, because we were talking about the state teachers contract, one of the advantages of the state teachers contract is that that means the state does assume the responsibility for salaries and health costs. So that's a very big chunk of the budget of a municipality, or excuse me, a school unit. So that would be a huge improvement right there, freeing them up either to return money to the property taxpayers or to fund those other programs that they are eager to do, whether it be in music or art or other programs.
All right, we're going to go to, let's see here. So many questions, which have not been asked yet. Now, this one, Dan, on Twitter. How does the legislature determine the efficacy of the current funding formula?
Well, it spent nearly half $1 million hiring an outside consultant that was the 125th with the governor. Had this firm come in and spend 2 years reviewing the program and issuing a report, and it came back saying it's actually working pretty well. But the punchline was that the state of Maine wasn't assessing the full cost of education, and they believe that we were underestimating the cost by about $300 to $400 million. And that is why that report didn't go anywhere. It wasn't the answer that everyone had hoped to hear. But what I took away from that was that as much as we are frustrated by it, as much as it has its ups and downs, but that when it's linked to programs like the homestead exemption and the property tax fairness tax programs for our citizens, that it actually works pretty well.
We're going to go to Shelley calling from Fairfield. Shelley, hi, go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Excuse me. I am the chairman of my school board, and I testified in front of the Education Committee on the statewide teacher contract. And I will tell you, like I mentioned to them, that one of the substantial problems that we have in our district is the insurance costs that have increased on us year after year after year. Now, I know the legislation changed to require the trust to give everybody what their ratings were. And in doing so, it actually cost our district a substantial amount of money. But we've tried to go outside of from using the trust and trying to get quotes from other insurance companies. And because the trust has such a stranglehold on the insurance in this state for teachers and teacher contracts, and not just teacher contracts. Once you have the teacher contract, I have five unions we have to deal with. And all of the unions are the same way, use the MEA trust. And to go outside and get a quote, we have to be able to get what our retirees insurance part is, and they won't give us that. So that's
all right. So I'm going to let our guests respond. Shelley, go ahead, Rebecca.
So the reason why some districts' health insurance costs have risen so dramatically is due mostly to the fact that it was pulled out of the larger pool, where risk was able to be spread out over a larger number of members. And when a district decides to then have its own policy or insurance program, then when you have several teachers that become gravely ill, either with cancer or a stroke or whatever, then that increases their policy more than if they had remained with a pool that maybe had several thousand teachers. Now they only have a pool of maybe 50 to 100. So that was, I believe, an unanticipated downside to that legislation that was passed.
Shelley, thanks for your call. We'll go to Mike, who's calling from Islesboro. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've been on our school board for 15 years. I just got done this spring. And I can tell you that I find it very hard to to believe any most of what I'm hearing today. You know, so education is about kids. The future of this state is about kids. We can't educate our kids. We have no future. I live on a little island that we educate K through 12, 80 to 100 kids, maybe 120 in a good couple years. And, you know, if you're not all in, not just all in the classroom, but if you can't support the school, the janitor, the cook, the guy that sweeps the lawn, the guy that cleans the toilet, you're not all in. You're not supporting our kids. Islesboro spends about $20,000 per pupil more than the state says we should spend. And that's what it really costs. You know, the voters in November said the state should be funding 55% of the total cost of education. And the Republicans have come up with every gimmick in the book to make that not happen. You change the rules every 3 years. We have teachers that we ask to volunteer on, you know, all kinds of committees for different kinds of graduation standards and evaluation standards. And we're chewing up thousands of hours, of volunteer hours on things that the policymakers of the state can't decide on and can't leave alone once they've decided.
Okay, Mike, we're coming to the end of the hour, so I'm going to give Representative Ginsler a chance to respond. Go ahead.
Yes, all I know is that the state, through the general fund, and that's provided by the taxpayers of the state of Maine, allocates over $1.1 billion to K through 12 education for approximately 176,000 students. And of course, that is matched by local spending as well. Surely, with that kind of funding, we must be able to provide good education, an equitable education, one that produces the outcomes that we expect. I can't imagine that we can't do it.
So, you know, I think it's important to remember what the 55% vote was about. We're not talking about additional increased education spending. We're talking about whether it's going to be paid by property taxes or state funding. And that's what the voters wanted.
Mike, thanks for your call. And it's going to be the last call this hour. Such an interesting discussion. We could go on and on and on, as is often the case. And thank you to both of my guests today. Senator Rebecca Millett is a Democrat from Cumberland County representing Senate District 2. She's on the State Education and Cultural Affairs Committee, as is Representative Phyllis Ginsler, who is a Republican representative from Bridgeton. And she's the ranking minority member on the committee. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Sam Dearin answered your calls. And we had additional help from Mal Leary. Speaking of additional help, last week when we broadcast from our Bangor studio, I neglected to thank two people who were instrumental in making it all happen, the two Nicks, Nick Woodward and Nick Godfrey. Thank you, Nick and Nick. Also want to thank John Bradford and Dan Works for their help last week in Bangor and today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can always find repeats, archives of this program at mainecalling.net. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about paddling in Maine. We'll learn about how and where to go kayaking, canoeing, stand-up paddleboarding, and more. And we will hear some important safety tips. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.